This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. When Apple co-founder Steve Jobs died this past week, some of the most heartfelt online tributes came from educators and students. Apple helped pioneer the use of computers in schools back in the 1980s. And as NPR's Larry Abramson reports, Steve Jobs' education legacy is growing with the popularity of using mobile devices in the classroom.
These fifth graders at Santa Rita Elementary in Los Altos, California, are doing math on their MacBooks. Their teacher is using an iPad to track their progress. You could see this scene in classrooms across the country. Steve Jobs placed a strong emphasis on getting a foothold in schools. Karen Cater worked in Apple's education department for a dozen years. She said Jobs' concept of the personal computer was always linked to learning.
He was very focused on making sure that all of the technologies were focused on people, that it was about augmenting human performance and helping people be as excellent as possible.
In the early days, Apple had to create a market for personal computers in schools. Liz Kolb, a lecturer at the University of Michigan, says the graphical user interface that Jobs popularized did that.
We had elementary students using computers. A few years before that, nobody thought that a third grader or fourth grader could use a computer.
At first, Apple dominated the education marketplace. The company spread the word through a savvy marketing campaign that cemented the loyalty of teachers. Tom Greaves, an education consultant in California, says Apple created a group of evangelists called Apple Distinguished Educators.
They go to shows, trade shows. They speak at conferences. If Apple has a school that would like to move over to Apple, they have them speak to Apple Distinguished Educators.
Soon, cheaper Windows machines ended up taking the lead among schools. But in recent years, according to Greaves, Apple has been resurgent and is now back to about a quarter of the education market. Tom Greaves says Apple's role has grown with the rise of mobile devices, from wireless laptops to iPhones and iPads.
Apple is growing much more rapidly on the mobile side than the other vendors. They got onto it earlier. As the world moves to mobile, then Apple reaped the benefits of that.
Although Windows machines still dominate, Apple has become the largest single vendor to schools. Tim Garten of the Maine Department of Education says he's gone with Apple for 10 years because the company unifies software, hardware, and support in a way that others cannot.
And that's because it's a total solution. It needs to have the wireless, it needs to have the device, it needs to have the professional development, it needs to have the software solution that's going to support all that.
Apple has been pushing just as hard into the higher education market. In a recent survey, nearly half of all college students said they plan to buy an Apple laptop. Eric Weil of Student Monitor did the survey. He says buying an Apple product ranks really high among all the priorities of college students.
Specifically, the Apple iPhone has a higher score than drinking beer.
Whether Apple products have been effective education tools is another question. Many still doubt whether all the money spent on technology has yielded much. But thanks to Steve Jobs' focus on the classroom, few schools ask whether they need technology. Now it's a question of how much and how to use it. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
To Libya now, where Muammar Gaddafi's old compound in the heart of Tripoli has been put to new use, as NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro explains in this reporter's notebook.
Gaddafi's compound in Bab al-Aziziyah used to be one of the most forbidding addresses in the country.
You are not allowed to come here for any other reason unless they asked you to come here, and most people, they will be not happy for a call to be in Bab al-Aziziyah.
That's Jamal, our translator here in Tripoli. He says an invitation into this compound would certainly have meant you were suspected of doing something wrong, and it wouldn't have ended well. But just last week, Tripoli's traditional Friday market moved locations to here, and this former palace of terror is now a kind of fairground.
So I'm walking through the market here, and there are literally hundreds of people, children, women, old men, young men, and they're selling everything. In front of me, there's motor oil, there's diapers, there's ketchup, there's t-shirts, shoes. Anything and everything people would want is being sold here now at the new Bab al-Aziziyah Friday market. Abdul Khader sells rebel trinkets right in the doorway of what used to be Gaddafi's residence. He says he never dreamed that he'd be able to sell his wares in the colonel's house. It's like a dream come true, he says.
Some things being sold are more deliberately controversial than others.
So in the Islamic world, dogs are not particularly well thought of. And actually, they have a section here where they're selling them right in front of Gaddafi's house, which I think adds insult to injury. How much are you selling him for?
Hamza Mohammed Saleh is asking $350 for his German Shepherd. He says selling dogs here is a direct insult to the former leader, which makes him very happy. While some are here to buy and sell, Gaddafi's compound also attracts the curious as well. So I'm now inside Gaddafi's house, and it's far from its former glory. There is graffiti all over the walls, and it's partially burned, but that hasn't stopped people from treating it like a tourist attraction. They have their cameras out, they're taking pictures of themselves, and indeed on the ground floor, some children are rollerblading on the smooth marble surfaces. Nearby at the live chicken stall, Salem Al-Nawal, who works in the oil sector, says he can't believe the scenes he's witnessing.
I wish I had a camera. I saw an old man trying a pants and trying a suit on in the open air.
What made you wake up this morning and decide to come to Bab al-Azizi on Friday?
You know, I heard that they were selling dogs and things and birds. So I said, I might as well just go and stroll there.
And now that you see his house, I mean, with all the graffiti and everything.
I did see that. And the man keep on appearing from that balcony or whatever you call it and telling us things and calling us names. And where is he?
Salem Al-Nawal says this market is the real symbol of the people's power.
People will always prevail. The aspiration of the people, no matter how poor, how uneducated, they will prevail. They are staying, and he's gone. And he cannot defeat the people's will.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Tripoli.
You're listening to NPR News. Another growing trend in the world of education has been the explosion in the number of students headed to for-profit colleges, schools like DeVry, Kaplan, and the University of Phoenix. Lately, these institutions have been subject to scrutiny and new regulations for their allegedly deceptive recruiting tactics and the high number of federal loan defaults among their students. Christopher Bea, an associate editor for Harper's Magazine, wanted to see what the for-profit college experience was like from a student's perspective. So he discreetly enrolled at the University of Phoenix, the country's largest for-profit university, and he wrote about it for the magazine's October issue. His experience is the basis for a critique, not just of the for-profit education industry, but of what he calls America's college for all mentality. Christopher Bea's article is titled Leveling the Field, What I Learned from For-Profit Education, and he joins us from our studios in New York. Christopher Bea, welcome.
Thank you.
We should point out that you do, in fact, have a bachelor's degree, and that for the purposes of this article, you lied to the admissions counselors at the University of Phoenix when you enrolled.
I did, yes. And I should say that I ultimately came clean to all of my classmates and to my teacher and did not include any students who were not comfortable being included.
What is the admissions process like, and what did you need to get into the school?
You need to show up and, in my case, write a check. In the case of most of the students, you need to be eligible for government funding, for Pell Grants and for subsidized government loans, which means you do have to have a high school diploma or equivalency.
And that is an important part of the funding structure of these schools, correct?
Absolutely. Phoenix gets about 89% of its revenue from the federal government.
Now, what did you think you were going to find, and what were you looking for going into this situation?
To be honest, I wasn't sure what I was going to find, which was part of the point. There's been a lot of talk about for-profit education recently because the industry has been growing so much and some of their practices have come into question. But there has been very little talk about what actually goes on in the classroom.
Tell us a little bit more about your classmates.
Well, there were a few people who had started degrees elsewhere, but my class was mostly students with less than 1 year of college experience, if any. They tended to have pretty broad ideas of what a college education was going to do for them, which is to say they weren't people who couldn't get the next promotion without a degree or people who needed a certain credential for some work they were doing. They had a vague sense that they wanted to improve their lives. And they had been told by University of Phoenix recruiters, among, I'm sure, many other people, that the best way to do that was to get a college degree.
Now, in your article, you essentially argue that it's not a good value, that it's not a good deal for the students in terms of what they're paying. It's not a good deal for us in terms of what we're paying as taxpayers. And can you describe what you mean by that? Because I'm sure lots of people who are paying tuition bills right now at public universities and private colleges feel like they're getting ripped off. So
sure.
How is this any worse?
Yeah, you know, there's a big argument going on about whether a college degree actually pays for itself in terms of your increase in lifetime earnings. And that's a very complicated question, and a lot of people who know this stuff better than I do disagree on it. But the short answer is that it depends where your college degree is coming from and how much you're paying for it. What doesn't seem in doubt to me is that for society as a whole, this is not a good investment of our resources at a time when resources are very scarce.
Of course, I mean, that's easy for you to say. You have a degree, right? I mean, what do you say to all these students who are trying to make it?
Well, I think everybody
should. And who equate having a degree with making it?
Well, I mean, that's the point right there, is that I think we need to change that attitude. I certainly believe in access to higher education for all. I'm not suggesting that we ought to track people out of degree programs, but I think we ought to offer alternatives, vocational training, other kinds of post-secondary school that isn't geared towards a degree. And I think these would be more valuable for a lot of people. And I think, frankly, people would prefer that option if they had it.
Christopher Bea is an associate editor for Harper's Magazine. His article, Leveling the Field, What I Learned from For-Profit Education, appears in the October issue. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We asked the University of Phoenix for a response. It reads in part, "The reality Americans face today is simple. Jobs today require higher education, yet more than 80 million working Americans don't have a bachelor's degree, and 50 million adults have never even tried to earn one. Clearly, there is no single solution to meeting this need. For some students, traditional colleges and universities are the best path. For others, working adults who support a family, for example, another path must be sought."
Dear Mr. President, I'm an avid supporter, donor, activist.
The White House receives some 20,000 letters and emails a day. So what happens to that blizzard of envelopes and the torrent of gigabytes? Believe it or not, they really are read by staff. 50 full-time mail analysts, 25 interns, and 1,500 volunteers pour through each message in a secret location near the White House. And each day, staffers choose 10 letters to be personally read by President Obama. John Santos wrote about the issue of gays and bullying.
I've written many times, and I don't know who reads these letters. I hope someone does. But I just wanted you to know that I applaud you for sending the message that it truly does get better.
11-year-old Nadrea Lattimore wrote to the president, worried about American education.
Sometimes I think if you're really smart, you get punished. The reason I think this is because there are kids in the class that are bad and the teacher has to stay on them for disrupting the class.
Thomas Ritter wanted to express how he felt about President Obama's efforts to pass a health care bill.
I hope that you will at least consider that if Congress has to try every strategy possible to pass a bill that it clearly has a majority to pass and still can't pass with bipartisan support, maybe we should pause and reflect. Do the right thing, not the political thing. Suggest a bill that all Americans can support. Thomas J. Ritter, citizen of the U.S.
Eli Saslow brings these stories together in a new book called 10 Letters, The Stories Americans Tell Their President. Saslow is a writer for The Washington Post who has covered the Obama White House, and he's in our Washington studios. Eli Saslow, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. We just heard the voice of, from one of the letter writers featured in the book, Thomas Ritter. Can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Sure. Thomas was is a pretty staunch conservative who lives in Plano, Texas. And he had watched Obama be elected. And at first, he tried to be a little bit optimistic about it, although he was always pretty skeptical about Obama. But especially sort of during the first year of Obama's presidency, as he watched bailouts happen, and then as he watched the health care reform process, he really became enraged. And one night, he was sitting there watching Fox News just after the health care bill passed, and he really just felt like the country was going in the wrong direction and he'd had enough. And he decided it was his moment to stand up. He wrote an email that night, a long email to Obama that was really, it's not something that he put a lot of forethought into. It was just pure passion and honestly a lot of anger.
And this one did get a response.
It did. Yeah, it got a response, and the response really shocked Thomas.
And we should read some of that response, actually.
Yeah, let me dig for it. Dear Mr. Ritter, I received your letter, and I appreciate your concerns about the toxic political environment right now. I do have to challenge you, though, on the notion that any citizen that disagrees with me has been targeted and ridiculed, or that I have made fun of teabaggers. I think a fair reading is that I've gone out of my way to listen to legitimate criticism, and to defend strongly the right of everyone to speak their mind, including those who routinely call me a socialist or worse. I sincerely believe that the health care reform bill was the right thing to do for the country. It certainly wasn't the smart political thing. And I hope that in the months to come, you will keep an open mind and evaluate it based not on the political attacks, but on what it does or doesn't do to improve people's lives. Sincerely, Barack Obama.
Did that letter do anything to change the opinions of Thomas Ritter?
It did, for a short time. I think it made him respect Obama tremendously, the fact that somehow this letter that was very critical had made its way to Obama's desk and that Obama had taken the time to respond. And, you know, Obama's response is sort of the lesson of this process in itself, the idea that everybody should be heard, everybody should be listened to, and that this sort of civil discourse is the way good decisions get made. And so I think Thomas, for a while, tried to be much more polite in the way that he addressed political topics. When he was talking with friends, he was more quick to defend Obama, or to at least defend that his intentions were good. But as time has gone on, a couple of years down the road, Obama has made many more decisions that have angered Thomas. I think he still respects him tremendously, but I think that he disagrees with the way a lot of things are going.
We also heard the voice of letter writer John Santos, and his story is interesting because he didn't quite get a reply back.
Right. Yeah, it was a different kind of reply in that one. And sometimes that's the way these letters work. John's letter, like a lot of these letters, was almost like a diary entry. I mean, it was incredibly honest and candid, in part because he thought nobody would probably ever read it. I mean, you send a letter to the president and it's sort of like putting a prayer in an envelope. I mean, the odds of having somebody read and respond to that seem remarkably remote. And so people are so candid, and the letters can be so real and heartbreaking. And John wrote, as the It Gets Better project was just beginning, this project of a bunch of gay Americans talking about sort of the way they were bullied growing up. And John had been bullied to the extent in Hawaii that he contemplated suicide and spent a lot of time growing up figuring out how he was going to kill himself.
Life was bad then, but it slowly got better. I attended a wonderful Catholic liberal arts university in California and learned there that God doesn't make junk. And whether gay, straight...
But his life improved in all these really remarkable ways, and now he's a major AIDS activist in Atlanta. And he wrote Obama about his experience. And that letter, in addition to, you know, maybe a half dozen other It Gets Better letters that I read, ended up convincing the president and his staff that it would be worth it for him to film one of these It Gets Better videos of his own.
As a nation, we're founded on the belief that all of us are equal and each of us deserves the freedom to pursue our own version of happiness, to make the most of our talents, to speak our minds, to not fit in. Most of all, to be true to ourselves. That's the freedom that enriches all of us. That's what America's all about. And every day, it gets better.
You also argue that each president's legacy was shaped in part by his relationship to the male. What did you mean by that?
Well, you can sort of see this interesting reflection of a lot of presidencies through how they handled all this male. FDR, who really crafted this new relationship with the American people during the fireside chats, got totally overwhelmed with mail to the point where it became a fire hazard, and he had to hire a separate staff to deal with this fire hazard that had accumulated in the White House. Then as the years went on, you know, Richard Nixon, at one point in his presidency, got very weary of receiving so much criticism, and he told his mail staff, to only send him letters that affirmed his position and agreed with what he thought, because he couldn't deal with the criticism anymore at that point. So it's sort of this interesting window into how presidents dealt with the public and what they were thinking at different times.
What was your access? Because I'm sure a lot of people hearing this might think, well, of course, you know, they showed him the letters that they wanted him to see.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Luckily for me, I think Obama and the White House believe that all letters are letters that I should see, because what they believe is in their interest to show is that he receives and listens to letters of all kinds. So they were very open in giving me access to letters. I read, you know, hundreds of letters over the course of this time and saw plenty that were extremely negative, plenty that were positive, and most that just were about people's lives. And in the end, the real access in this book and these stories is based with those people and their lives and the issues that they're going through. And so the access from the White House was great in that I got to see these letters and I had this real privilege of reading basically over the president's shoulder for a year. But the real access was then asking these people who'd written to the president about their problems to say, hey, can I come out and spend a week with you, 2 weeks with you, while you are dealing with these problems you wrote to the president about? And so that meant I was with people as they were going to their bankruptcy hearings, or as a woman in Arizona was deciding whether or not she was going to move back to Mexico in the wake of a new immigration law. And really, those were the people who I think were pretty heroic in letting me just tag along in these really difficult circumstances sometimes and write about what they were going through and what they were talking to Obama about.
Eli Sasso, we appreciate you for bringing their stories.
Oh, please. Thank you. It was my privilege. I appreciate them for letting me bring their stories, and I appreciate you for having me here.
Eli Saslow's book is called 10 Letters, The Stories Americans Tell Their President. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Al Davis, the legendary owner of the Oakland Raiders, died yesterday. He was 82. His tough teams earned legions of loyal fans, and his maverick style helped transform the National Football League. NPR's Allison Keyes has this remembrance of the man viewed by many as one of the most important figures in professional football.
Whether you're a Raiders fan or not, you've got to admit the guys in the silver and black could be an exciting team to watch.
74 yards for Marcus Allen. And the Raiders are starting to shove this one in the winner's column.
And when they did, in 1984, their third Super Bowl under Al Davis, ESPN panelist and University of Maryland sports journalism professor Kevin Blackstone says it was all about Davis's signature style of coaching.
He always had a quarterback who could throw deep and always had receivers who could run fast and make those catches and make for an exciting brand of football.
Davis sought out cast-offs from other teams who then became fierce disciples of the silver and black. Blackstone says Davis's defensive line played hard-hitting on the edge of your seat football.
I think he gave the NFL a flavor. He introduced through his players a certain swagger in the NFL, and he created a really raucous fan base.
In 1963, he was named general manager and head coach of the Oakland Raiders and was coach of the year of the American Football League. Later, Davis was one of the reasons the AFL and rival NFL merged, but the pugnacious man with the slicked back ducktail and trademark black leather jacket was also a thorn in the side of the NFL. Davis successfully sued the league to move the Raiders to L.A. in the early 1980s, and journalist Blackstone adds that Davis was an early and consistent supporter of diversity in the league.
You got the first Hispanic coach in Tom Flores. You got the first black coach in modern NFL history in Art Shell. And you got the first woman CEO of an NFL franchise in Amy Trask.
In 1992, Davis was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. 3 years later, he moved the Raiders back to Oakland. But in the last 10 years or so, the team's reputation and Davis's faltered. Still, that doesn't diminish the effect Davis had on football. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell calls Davis a true legend of the game whose impact and legacy will forever be part of the NFL. Davis himself, speaking to the Raiders after their 1981 Super Bowl victory, made his love for the team clear.
Take pride and be proud
Your commitment to excellence and your will to win will endure forever. You were magnificent.
Davis's mantra was just win, baby. Al Davis was 82 years old. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
This is NPR News.